You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to the Leadership Special, a show which features conversations with Christians in leadership about the topics that really matter. I'm Andy Peck, your host, and I've had the privilege of interviewing Christian leaders on over 1,000 shows, and so hope you'll enjoy this next conversation and will join us again next week. And it's a happy Easter. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith." So whatever kind of leadership you're engaged in today, as Christians, the reality of the resurrection is central to what we're about. So on this Easter Sunday, I've invited Chris Sinkinson to share how he sees the proofs of the resurrection. He is Associate Minister at Lansdowne Church and Director of the School for Discipleship, which the church runs in the Bournemouth area. He lectured in apologetics, among other things, at Moorlands College, and his books include Back Chat, Answering Christianity's Critics, and Confident Christianity. When he's not teaching the Bible, he can also be found volunteering somewhere in the Middle East as an archaeologist, Indiana Jones style. So, Chris, great to have you. Welcome back to the Leadership Show.
Great to be with you, Andy. It's been a while since we last spoke.
Well, indeed. I did add it up, and it's about 38 years we've known each other. I don't think either of us are really as old as that, but hey. So it's great to see how the Lord's led you within his purposes since then. We'll look at your wider ministry a bit later, but let's look at the resurrection. It's a creedal belief, of course, that Jesus rose from the dead. But maybe some Christians say those words, but deep down, I'm not sure there's really reasons for believing them. So take us through the apologetic reasons for believing that Jesus rose from the dead.
Well, Andy, a happy Easter, because, of course, the Easter event, the empty tomb, is right at the heart of the Christian faith. And you get that from the preaching in the New Testament, that the kind of catalyst, if you like, for everything else that unfolds is the empty tomb on the first day of the week. So you look at the preaching in the book of Acts, the early church. It's the significant component there in all four Gospels. So the resurrection is really the launch pad for what the good news is, what is being proclaimed. It's interesting in Acts chapter 17, when Paul preaches in Athens, when they go into the pagan territory, the summary of his message there, and obviously Luke is only summarizing it, but it is that Paul gets to preach the resurrection. And some people say, well, where's the cross? But of course, you can't preach the resurrection without preaching the cross. Christ must have died for him to be raised again. But it's through the empty tomb that the cross makes sense. And in that sense, of course, without an empty tomb, without a physical resurrection, you just don't have the Christian faith. You've got nothing else to add to the thought world of the Old Testament, for example. The resurrection is the key to what the good news is really all about. So in terms of the apologetics, it's therefore always been very important in the history of the church to front load, shop window, a physical bodily resurrection. It's quite interesting. One of the early church apologists, we call them apologists, the early church evangelists, called Justin Martyr. And that's very early. Justin is within 100 years of the New Testament being written. So we go right back to the early church. And Justin, one of his works that remains is called On the Resurrection. And the key in the argument is it's a physical resurrection. He's at pains to stress it's a bodily resurrection. So you don't get an apologetic built on the idea that the resurrection is a metaphor or a poem for finding new life or finding inspiration. It's the bodily physical resurrection that's right at the core. And in our apologetics, that's really been evident for 2,000 years that we've wanted to emphasize that. When the church has drifted from that, there's been lots of other problems that have resulted. So a physical bodily resurrection is key. And, you know, I mean, Andy, that really connects us back to the whole Old Testament Jewish Israelite worldview, which emphasizes very much the sense of the body is really important. We're not like spirits trapped inside a body needing to escape. The physical body really does matter, and the physical creation matters. And so that apologetic that we have, that's a physical bodily resurrection. Now we can go further in talking about how we make that case, but that we want to make that case, whether we do it well or not, that we want to make that case, that's part of the DNA of the Christian faith.
Sure. And for skeptics today, people who rub shoulders with Christians and say, you don't still believe in that, do you? I guess at that point you perhaps say, well, what other explanation is there for the life of the early church and for the spread of the church across the Roman Empire as it was in those days?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the problem of how do you explain away the empty tomb is the kind of that's the reverse apologetic, in the sense of how do you explain it if it's not the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus? So claims that it was a lie or a myth or a deceptive propaganda put out by the early church. None of these really add up, particularly because the claim, the resurrection claim, is not something that kind of benefited the early followers of Jesus. They were rejected by their Jewish background. They were oppressed by the Roman rulers. They often died in pretty horrific circumstances for proclaiming the empty tomb. So those kind of explanations don't really add up in terms of how anybody came up with this idea. The Christian faith is countercultural, and in that sense, it can get you into trouble. And yet, despite that, the Christian church grew. And an explanation for where it came from, well, we come back into the empty tomb. The positive apologetic, of course, is to also make the case that the New Testament, the Gospels, the four Gospel accounts, are based very clearly in reliable, sober, eyewitness evidence. And we do that. That's why I have the interest in archaeology, as you know, Andy. We can do that by showing how all the things we can test by normal historical method, claims concerning places and people and events, they do all stack up. This is not later poetic imaginative exercises. This is based on real eyewitness evidence. And it even includes, very importantly, things that would have been embarrassing to the authors. So this is sometimes called the criteria of embarrassment. If I wanted to invent a story, I would do it in a way that makes me look good, makes my credibility look good, and I might embellish it in that way. Well, what we find with the Gospels is a really raw historical information that actually has embarrassing things regarding the first followers, not least of which, and this is important in our culture, the first eyewitnesses to the resurrection were women. Now, in that culture at that time, all those years ago, a woman's eyewitness testimony was not counted as having anything like the value of a male eyewitness. So, if you're going to make the story up in those days, all those years ago, of course you'd have credible men turning up to find the empty tomb. It would be based on male eyewitness evidence. Well, not the Gospels, because they don't tell us something which is propaganda. They reveal the real historical basis of our faith. And it's women who are first to see the empty tomb.
So the proofs for the resurrection, Chris, have been classically important in evangelism. I can go back to my student evangelism days, and maybe and you can too. I'm aware that approaches to apologetics are less important, some approaches anyway, with young adults today who have different kinds of questions. What's your experience with respect to whether the resurrection still is a part of our arsenal, as it were, in terms of what we share with people?
Yeah, great. Look, I think there is a very interesting cultural moment we're in. I mean, there is definitely something going on here. The increase of the sales of Bibles, anecdotally, we see many younger people coming to church. Interesting that we have many people seem to be coming to church from that younger generation who have parents who are not interested. So the middle age has been so saturated in skepticism. And other reasons that they're not interested, but the younger generation, there seems to be a real awakening of interest in Christianity. So, got a lot, there's lots of anecdotal evidence for that, let alone some of these studies that have been published, the research and so on. Now, in that context, the questions are changing as well. And that raises all sorts of interesting issues for apologetics, because I think what we find are the questions being asked nowadays, I find anyway, are much more to do with issues of justice, for example. There'll be questions surrounding issues of justice, fairness, ethics in society, global politics, and so on. So issues of justice rate very high, but also issues of personal meaning and identity. Who am I? What am I? Will AI ever become an organic identity? So questions of identity and meaning and purpose, those are sort of right up at the top there. Whereas issues that would have been classic traditional apologetics have dropped down the list. Now, I would say two things about that. Number one, let's not lose sight of classic apologetics. We still need it. We still need to provide a robust case that this is real history because culture changes, so who knows what it's going to be like in 10 years' time. So let's not ditch or drop the classic traditional arguments because they are good ones and they remind us the Bible is not true because we want it to be true. It is true because it's historically rooted. And so let's not be somehow distracted by the great interest in the Bible to think that means people therefore believe it's true, because people may be interested for all sorts of spiritual reasons or psychological reasons. They still need that classic apologetics. So number one, in any preaching on a resurrection day or any Sunday, really, I think we need to be making that case that it's really historical and not just think that's an assumed kind of knowledge. But the second point is those questions being asked today actually are addressed by the classic case for the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus. Because when we think about it, a lot of the questions are still coming back to issues of what is real meaning? What is life really all about? What's creation really all about? And we answer those questions not with a philosophical maxim, but with the truth that the eternal God has stepped into time and space. And that link between a God of eternity outside of space and time, who's entered into space and time, walked and talked in human flesh, that's going to be the key to answering the most important questions of life. So I think that actually at both levels, the resurrection, the bodily resurrection, remains really core in our evangelism and preaching.
Excellent. And of course, apologetics also serves the Christian, because many come to faith perhaps with relatively little knowledge and then think, hang on, I've got all these questions. And apologetics helps to root them and establish them in the faith very, very much. So thank you for explaining that so much. Serving you, sir, used to serve at Alderholt Church and now at Lansdowne. You must have preached your fair share of Easter sermons. And the congregations, of course, have heard their fair share as well. How do you keep it fresh for yourself and those who are listening?
I mean, it's a great question, just generally, to be honest with you, because you can find, obviously, as the years go by, you're preaching on passages you've preached on before. And I think one of the things that really helps me to keep it fresh in terms of all preaching, actually, this is a general point, really. I don't enjoy repeating content. I don't enjoy repeating material. If you're out and about preaching at a conference or a convention, you're inevitably kind of repeat illustrations or stories that kind of help you to explain a passage. But in terms of actually preaching what the Bible teaches from a passage, I always love to keep it fresh. I don't like repeating material. And so for me, in terms of study, and I genuinely mean this, I'm not over dramatizing. In my study, when I'm preparing, I always like to think and ask myself, if this is the last sermon I ever preach, if this is it, and I never preach again after this sermon, is this really what I think God wants me to say? And generally, and again, I don't think I'm over-dramatizing, generally, I do think I land at a place before I preach where, okay, if this is my last one, I'm good with that. This is what I believe God wants to say today. And so for me, I suppose the answer to your question about freshness is I'm also preaching to myself. I'm trying to listen to what God is saying to me today. And we never exhaust the meaning and significance of any theological theme or any biblical passage. And when it comes to the resurrection, there's so much depth. Now, obviously, there are some essentials about the resurrection that we will repeat, and not just on an Easter weekend. We will repeat those. But I think the particular passage we choose, the angle we take on it, the root in, even this conversation with you now, Andy, I mean, it's raising sort of thoughts in my head about like identity and meaning and so on, and thinking, yeah, there's another way in to making that connection to our culture and to the questions people are asking today.
We stand on the shoulders of giants, of course, those who've gone before, those who've written about this topic. Are there particular books on the resurrection or on this theme that have particularly helped you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, funnily enough, I've already mentioned that early church father text, Justin Martyr. You can get that free online. I mean, it's out of copyright. So it's 2,000 years old on the resurrection, and it's one of the shorter ones of his as well. So if you want to stretch yourself with historical reading, Justin Martyr on the resurrection is an interesting read. And it's nice to be reminded that the convictions we have about the bodily resurrection go way back in terms of early church history. In terms of more up-to-date material, there's a number of apologists who I think have written very helpfully on the resurrection. So we could list people like William Lane Craig and Habermas, Gary Habermas. Michael Licona, his book on the resurrection, Licona, Licona, is probably one of the kind of state-of-the-art volumes. It's quite large on the resurrection, and it's very detailed in terms of the relevant passages. Nobody will agree with everything in the book, but it's a substantial, robust case philosophically and exegetically for the resurrection. It's not a light read, you know. It's one that requires plenty of attention. It's you know, textbook level. But I think Lacona's book is a great summary of that kind of content for anyone and everyone.
So, Chris, some people have played a little bit of store on the Turin Shroud and whether this gives any light at all on the resurrection. What do you make of it?
It comes and goes in the news, the Turin Shroud. I mean, in the late 1980s, there was carbon dating done that suggested it was a medieval fake. And then later, there was fresh research that showed the carbon dating had been done on a repair patch on the Turin Shroud, and that there's other evidence concerning the shroud that does suggest it's genuine. And yeah, this debate sort of comes and goes. I've always been really intrigued by the Turin Shroud. So I'm not totally up to date with the latest, but I've always been intrigued by it. My feeling with the Turin Shroud, having read it, is that whatever it is extraordinary, and it came about by means we can't yet explain. Now, whether it is the actual Shroud of Jesus, there are many indicators that suggest it could well be a first century shroud. We're not sure how the image formed. I mean, some suggest some kind of radioactivity involved that would leave that kind of image on a shroud, because it's clearly not paint, so it's not something like that. The only other explanation in town for the Turin Shroud really is that it's some kind of medieval photographic technique that somebody had managed to achieve, maybe with some pigments as well, but managing to leave a photo negative impression on the shroud. But I've looked at examples of where people have tried to achieve that today. So using all the technology available in the medieval world to try and create a kind of photographic image, they look nothing like the Turin Shroud. They don't even come close. So if it's not the Shroud of Jesus, it remains very intriguing. And the way I've used it in terms of preaching and teaching, I've referred to the Turin Shroud, and I wouldn't want to say that it's a proof, because it'll always be debated. That kind of material would be. But I would say it provides a remarkable illustration of, if the shroud that Jesus had been wrapped in were found, it probably would look something like this. And so the many, many details of the wounds and the marks and so on the body, all of those kind of build a very impressive picture of the kind of impact you might expect from the resurrection of Jesus. So I think it's going to remain an intriguing one. I think it comes onto the record in the 13th century. That's one of the reasons why people doubt its antiquity. 13th century would be Middle Ages. But having said that, it comes onto the record at the just after the fall of Byzantium, which became Istanbul. And that was really the fall of the Eastern Church. And many things came from the East at that time, including our really early Greek New Testament manuscripts. It's part of the reason for the Reformation, actually, the fall of the Eastern Church, which brought those Greek manuscripts west into the Roman Catholic Church. So in amidst all of that material, that's probably where the Turin Shroud came from. And of course, that's why it's not in our records before the 13th century, but it could well have been preserved in a church somewhere in that Eastern Mediterranean world that could go back to the time of Jesus.
Well, fascinating stuff. Thanks for your insight. Chris, you've moved from serving as a tutor at Morelands College to Lansdowne Church, and that's including setting up a school for discipleship. So what was the vision behind it, and how's it going?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I've been involved in church ministry for many years, Old Alt, as you mentioned, and before that, Moredown Baptist Church in Bournemouth, another church. And our paths overlapped in UCCF, actually, in student ministry. And so the Bible College experience for me was wonderful, to be able to spend, I think it was about maybe even 15 years, actually, teaching in a Bible college, because I'd spent time in the academic world in the secular university. So I really enjoyed my time at Moorlands College, which is a great training place. If you want to get a degree in theology, there are other good colleges available too. But my heart really is for training in the local church. And so for me, an opportunity came up to go back into pastoral ministry at this church in Bournemouth. But also, as part of that, to be involved in creating another form of training and theological education. So, with another colleague, actually, Chris Jack, who'd been at London Bible College, London School of Theology before as well, we really pioneered this school for discipleship. And what we're doing here, I mean, this is nothing new, of course. There are many training schemes, and we're providing a 1-year training program. It's a discipleship course. It can be personal enrichment as well as for local interns and so on. But it teaches good, solid mainstream evangelical theology. So this is a 1-year course that we run in Bournemouth. And I would say it covers the kind of first year of a degree in terms of theology. But a distinctive is very much the Bible is the textbook. So it really is rooted in studying the Bible, reading the Bible, and applying the Bible to the whole of life. Now, what we're also doing is extending it online and hopefully through hubs. We're trying to see if we can create hubs elsewhere. But we've got a lot of online resources now, which listeners can follow up if they're interested. And, you know, Andy, what a day we're living in. With our online opportunities, the opportunities we have to provide training globally. So we don't want SFD to be a kind of national institution. We've got a hub already in Myanmar, in Yangon, and that's a kind of road testing, if you like, whether our theological training can really bless the church in a war-torn, very troubled country. But if it works there, it could work anywhere. And it's a two-way street. So all of our School for Discipleship students can be partnered as kind of e-disciples, let's call them, e-disciples, with those learning and studying out in Myanmar. And so it's a way in which we disciple each other and we learn from each other because it's a two-way street. We're not just sending them resources. We want to hear from them what they're learning and what we can benefit from them. So you can see how moving to Lansdowne for me wasn't sort of just like leaving a Bible college to go into pastoral ministry. It was also a great opportunity to take further some of the passion God's given me anyway, to use good theology in training men and women for ministry.
People who know Bournemouth, of course, will know it's a great place for English language learning. Many internationals attend Bournemouth for the language schools. And of course, your church is increasingly international in its feel.
Yes, yeah, very much so. So all the challenges of intercultural kind of ministry are things that we're working through at the moment. And again, I mean, I keep saying this, but these are exciting times, really, aren't they? I mean, there are massive issues, you know, issues of immigration right on our doorstep, issues of cultural cohesion, what is the narrative that holds our nation together, all sorts of complicated issues. And I don't want to kind of be superficial and ignore those, but weaving into the fact that if you look at church history, the gospel primarily has spread through migration. I mean, God bless the missions work and the great history of missions, but actually, historically, it's migration that's been the key to the spread of the gospel all around the world. And so, what a day we're living in today where we have people from so many different nations here on our doorstep in Bournemouth in southern England, and they come and they go, and they come and they go with the beliefs and the ideas that they pick up. And so, what a time to be living in terms of the Great Commission and the spread of the gospel.
Yeah, and many from countries where to hear and understand the gospel would be very difficult, and where churches are persecuted and struggling. So, wonderful to hear. Yeah. So, how can anyone local to Bournemouth connect with your school and what you're up to?
Yeah, so we have a website, sfd.org.uk, so anybody can go on there. And of course, that's not just local to Bournemouth. You'll see on the front page information on our Bible College in a Box. We created one box, a box, not much bigger than a shoebox, a bit bigger than a shoebox. And into that box, we've put the essential resources, textbooks, other guides, material for evangelism and so on. So we put it into a box, and the QR code in there links to all of our video content. So actually, anybody can use that. They can use that in their own time. They can use it in their own way. Here in Bournemouth, though, if you go onto the website, you can make a link with us, and you would be able to sign up if you want to study with us in person in September. We limit that to 20, okay? Because the kind of dynamic of study and so on, we have 20. So we've got about 12 different churches so far who have either sent us interns or have people who are. Andy, when I talk about like leadership training, I mean, this could be at many different levels. So some people are perhaps early retired, they want to give golden years to some form of ministry or home group leading or youth work. We've got others who come in who are just out of sixth form college, not sure what to do with their lives. So the age range really is 18 to, I think last year, someone in their 70s. So it's quite a huge age range. Very different kind of stories they would tell. So anybody in the local area who's a Christian believer, wants to serve in their local church in some capacity, and who would be able to come and join us. It's during the day, Wednesday, 9 to 5. Very welcome. We're also running some evening classes. So we're trying to create as much flexibility for people who can't access an in-person during the day course. So we've got a leadership course actually in June, which is a short, only short, 8 hours course that runs through June. So again, if you're in within reach of Lansdowne and Bournemouth, you'd be very welcome to join that. But otherwise, do keep an eye on our online content, because like I say, I really think that we need more and more ways of trying to deliver training in with flexibility, low cost as well. I mean, we don't charge anything, so apart from the cost of buying a box, it's all free. There's a fee for the 1 year in-person program, but it's very, very modest. So we're not trying to make this as a sort of business. It's not a business really. Just trying to share good practice and encourage others. And the programs we run, we're not expecting this to do everything. So people will no doubt go on to do maybe they'll go on to do a degree if they want to go that route, or maybe they'll go on and do a kind of curacy or an assistant pastorate if it's that route. So this is part of the picture of how we can help develop and encourage leaders for another generation.
Wow, exciting to hear, Chris. And thank you so much for all you shared at the start of our conversation about the reality of the resurrection of Jesus on this Easter Sunday. So, for us, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy. Happy Easter. God bless.
Thank you. It was a great joy chatting with Chris Singleton, the Associate Minister, Lansdowne Church in Bournemouth. He mentioned a number of books in our conversation, the book by Justin Martyr on the resurrection, which apparently is available free online. And then other books, the one by William Lane Craig is called The Sun Rises. That's the sun, S-O-N. Gary Habermas, Habermas, his book is called On the Resurrection. And then the book, The Case for the Resurrection by Michael R. Licona, L-I-C-O-N-A. And Chris was also talking about the school for discipleship, which is based down in Bournemouth, a limit to 20 people. So get in early if you want to. Go to their website, sfd.org.uk. So it's as always, there's plenty of archived versions of the Leadership Show. Go to the Premier.plus, the app, or the website, and you can find many hundreds of past shows on various topics and speakers, of course. So do go there and enjoy that material. So this is Andy Peck. Thank you for your company. Looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.